Hello, everybody. This is Ben Fung with UpDoc Media, and I wanted to invite you to this special mini podcast series we're calling Practice Compliance. With me is the one and only Nancy Beckley. She is the one I trust when it comes to all things compliance. And while compliance isn't always known to be an exciting topic, it needs to be because it has everything to do with elevating the profession from within. And we're going to be talking about topics like CashPT and what accurate supervision is supposed to be and some of the scarier stories out there. And of course, we are taking questions and we've already received a whole bunch from social media. So stay tuned and see if we get to answer your questions this episode. All right, guys, I'd like to introduce to you Nancy Beckley, and honestly, I would like for her to introduce herself. Nancy, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into this compliance world, into the world of rehab and therapy and healthcare at large, and how you have just this monstrous footprint of being all things compliance?
Well, hey, Ben, it's so great to be with you today, and I sure wish I could be in San Diego with you, my second favorite city. So how I got in compliance, that's really an interesting question. I've been in therapy my whole life, meaning I've been in rehabilitation therapy with most of my career, about 18 years in inpatient rehab hospitals. In fact, my husband, as you know, worked at Sharp Rehab, and that's how I met him when we were both in inpatient rehab. So we have a little bit of a connection there.
Therefore, the second favorite city in San Diego, exactly.
Exactly. There's no secret. That's why my favorite city. So I started out actually in recreational therapy during the heydays of spinal cord injury. So I worked primarily in the physical therapy department. I did aquatics. I started wheelchair sports programs. So I was in during the really, really exciting time. And of course, now there's no money for people that have spinal cord injuries to be in rehab. So the exciting days are long since passed.
Yeah.
But as I moved through my career, I kind of transitioned over to managed care and managed care contracting and rehab. I started consulting 22 years ago, and that was the hot topic. Then the Balanced Budget Act hit us in 1997, and it gave us all those terrific things like the SNF PPS, the home health PPS, the therapy cap at the time, which was $1,500. And people
love to get that back.
Yeah, people said, we don't want to talk managed care. We want to talk about what's going on in Medicare. And so the very next year, the Office of Inspector General published the first compliance program guidance, and it was for hospitals. 2 years later, they published a guidance for physicians and small practices. And in very teeny print in the Federal Register, it said, this is the ideal compliance program for physical therapists in private practice. And my career started at that point, Ben. So I've been doing compliance training, compliance webinars, on-site compliance, helping providers prospectively have a compliance program in place, and unfortunately working with far too many providers who have stepped the wrong way. I'm not talking about the criminal element, because there's plenty of that, and I don't work with them, but I'm talking the poor provider that just didn't know what they needed to do and got in a bit of trouble. And that could be a bit of trouble with their Medicare administrative contractor or with the OIG, pulled their number to do an audit, or they had a whistleblower on board, an employee that just decided they wanted to say they're doing something bad here. And generally it's because the practice doesn't know the rules. So fast forward, I've been in compliance for a long, long, long time. I feel like I'm the boat anchor of compliance. But to me, compliance is incredibly exciting because it helps providers that are physical therapists stay out of trouble. And for the passion that I'm seeing from the new group of DPTs and PTAs coming out of school today, excited to start their own practices, excited to get to an outpatient or a SNF setting or the setting of their dreams, whether it be PEDS or, you know, working with developmentally disabled, people should understand at a level so they don't get in trouble what the rules are, particularly with federal healthcare programs, because the laws are pretty strict.
I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, it's people get so passionate and we don't cover this stuff in school. We don't cover this stuff in CEUs. I mean, compliance and business and marketing isn't the sexy topic in rehab therapies. It's, you know, manual therapy and all the other stuff. And it's not a problem until it's a problem.
Right. And it's and people that are going out for job interviews, you know, I follow everything that you're writing on Facebook. You pop up at any time of the night or day. It's what's kind of funny. And of course, we're in different time zones. So I could be watching you at 1 a.m. and it's really kind of funny. And I'm going, hey, I know that guy. But people go to a job interview and they're thinking, wow, this is San Diego. This is a great place to work. Or they're at a particular facility where they're going, wow, there's some fantastic therapists here that have some advanced skills that I'd like to learn. Or they want to go back to their hometown in some, you know, rural section of the U.S. and just follow their passion there after they've graduated from school. So people go to job interviews with different expectations. And I know from following your group that a large part is finding out if they have can get a salary that's going to help them pay off their student loans. So even though salary is probably not the number one issue, it certainly bubbles up there with everything. And my guess is, based on the number of calls that have come my way and emails and whatnot, people reaching out, that compliance might not even be on the list of questions that candidates ask. Do you think so?
I don't think it is, which is ironic because when we did the, you know, we've done this 2 years in a row, the DPT Talent Acquisition Report, and they list culture as their number one concern, and then salary, which is funny because the definition right now of culture includes almost every element of compliance. You know, is this a quote mill? Are the supervisation rules accurate? All these different things, you know, they really fall under the compliance. And so I think that's why I'm so excited about doing this thing with you.
I think it's incredibly exciting. So let's get into what does a candidate need to be prepared to do when they get to a job interview. You're giving them a long list of things to do. You're helping them get prepared. You're helping them pull their resume together to get some questions, know how to do some research. So let me give a couple of ideas about going to get your research on compliance. So there's a couple of things candidates can do. First of all, they put their ear to the ground. What have they heard about this player? Now, just because you're hearing rumors that it's a mill, that doesn't mean it's true. You know, I always, in compliance, you like to deal with facts. So have they had a problem? Have they, the Department of Justice published a, you know, civil agreement about them? Have they been in a corporate integrity agreement? Unfortunately, Ben, there's far too many therapists today that are showing up on the problem list, sort of the hall of shame at the Office of the Inspector General. Yeah, and they're for, you know, things such as just not doing well in an audit because they didn't know the rules, all the way down to when they knew an audit was going to come, they decided to alter records. So it's like the government shows up and says, we're going to need to look at your records from 2014 and 2015. And you realize, my gosh, I need to alter the records because I didn't really do it. Exactly. So, you know, so people are doing that kind of stuff. So let's talk about SNFs, because I know that seems to be a hotbed right now.
That's a super hot topic right now, yeah.
Super, super hot topic, because there's been a number of the very large SNF organizations, and some of them are intricately linked with their contract therapy company. So they either own the contract therapy company or they exclusively contract with them or one of the combinations. And what happens, you know, in a SNF, as you know, because you've had that experience, is people want to get patients into the highest rug rates as possible. So when they contract with a therapy company or have their own in-house therapy, they really encourage therapists to ensure that people get at that highest rug level, you know, the RUV, you know, and get them right up there. In fact, we've seen in some of the settlements for millions and millions and millions of dollars that people actually had emails and notes and PowerPoint things basically saying, you know, you must get a certain percentage of your people in these rug rates. And then what's happened is that the government has been wise to this, so it's been put on the radar. I think the Kindred Care Rehab Care case is a great case to take a look at. So, you know, when you go to a SNF and you're going to interview, you might want to just say, what's your compliance program like? But before you get there, you want to know, have they been on the bad actors list? Have you heard anything about them? And by the way, just because somebody is on the bad actors list doesn't mean it's a bad place to work. I would say that Rehab Care Kindred Care right now is probably a better place to work because they're under a corporate integrity agreement. So they're having to follow a substantial amount of rules and have a mandatory compliance plan in place. So doing research on the web, you know, search therapy at the Office of the Inspector General, or, you know, check around with some other people that you may know that work in compliance and say, do you know anything about this type of a group? You know, there's logical things that you could look at Glassdoor and other HR sites, but Glassdoor is not about compliance. People might tell you that you have to work and see patients, but we don't want to confuse productivity with compliance. There's a lot of issues regarding productivity and compliance, but just because an employer is asking you to work an honest 8-hour day doesn't mean that they're asking you to do anything that's untoward.
Right. Not to sway the RV blend so much that, you know, everybody seems to be an RU, you know?
And exactly. So, you know, and another thing, when you're in outpatient therapy, there's a number of cases that are out there right now on the OIG's audit plan report. And these are people that just got randomly selected because they have a high Medicare profile billing. Is that bad? No, it just means they see a lot of Medicare patients. And a lot of therapists have a passion about treating the elderly. They're certified in geriatrics by the APTA, and they choose to treat a population that's primarily Medicare. So one would expect that their caseload is largely Medicare. And so that might get you, and unfortunately, it bubble to the top of the list for an OIG report.
Kind of a false negative, but you'll be there. But I mean, if you have the records, if you stayed compliant and you get audited, nothing bad happens. And they're not out to get you. They're just there to make sure that you're compliant, right? And yeah. I think if we double back to, I think you mentioned something great about detecting for compliance in the interview stages of going in the job market, whether you're a new grad or a seasoned veteran of the clinical world, it's always going to be a concern. And having sat in the director's chair before, I can tell you from my side, I would not be in the least offended if a candidate would ask me questions about compliance or productivity. So what are some good questions that they can, kind of innocuously and respectfully ask in the early stages of an interview, just to kind of, pardon the term, sniff out any problems?
That's great, Ben. I love it. First of all, when you get on board, you know, they might ask you a couple questions to get you, you know, eased into the interview and settled down. Interviewees are always challenged to come up with great questions that are well thought out. And I think asking a company, no matter if it's an outpatient therapy practice, a home health company, a SNF, or a hospital, to just say, do you have a compliance program? And then when the person, you know, that's interviewing you says, yes, we have a compliance program, that's always a good sign. Your follow-up question could be, you know, do you have a code of conduct? Is it published on your website? How does your compliance program work? And actually, for example, you know, picking one of your old places, Sharp Rehab, it's likely that their code of conduct is published on their website. So you actually could have taken a peek at it before, and then you could potentially score some additional interview points by saying, yeah, I looked on your website and I saw your code of conduct, and I just wanted to ask you, you know, is your chief compliance officer accessible?
That would impress me. That would very much impress me if somebody came up, say, hey, I did the research and, what's the process of accessing that compliance officer?
You want to be able to access the compliance officer, and you want to know how you report something. So that's probably your next critical question. If they tell you they've got a compliance program, you might want to say, then if I have a concern, how do I report my concern? And any compliance program, that's a critical element of the compliance program, your ability to report a concern and the company in turn to have a policy on non-retaliation. And, you know, this the whole thing in the therapy industry, particularly with SNFs, the whole thing has bubbled up with our national associations because therapists felt they didn't have a place to turn to. They felt that if they reported a concern, they were either going to lose their job or be retaliated in some other way, that they would never find another job. And, you know, so people want to be reassured that there's a policy on non-retaliation when they ask these questions.
And that's huge.
And probably the It's huge. And you know, from Ben, places that you've worked at, and probably when you went over to, you know, the independent rehab place in San Diego where you were at, that there's compliance training that's generally mandatory for all employees. And we talk about compliance training being how to prevent fraud, waste, and abuse, how to prevent HIPAA violations, and what are your obligations under HIPAA. And then more importantly, you know, what are your obligations with respect to your job? So that's where you're drilling down to. What I do in the compliance training that I offer is I make all my examples specific to therapy. It's of no use to a therapist to try to translate compliance training in general unless there's some very, very specific rehab examples. And try, and you know, so you want to find out, do you have annual compliance training? Will I be taught how to document? Will I be told the rules? Will I be instructed in what the relevant rules are for the setting that I'm working in? You know, for example, let's just take group therapy. Group therapy is different in every setting we're taking a look at. Inpatient rehab, SNFs, and outpatient therapy. You know, what's the 8-minute rule? How does it work? How do we bill? How do we code? So you want to ask, what kind of compliance training will I get? And when will I get it? And will it help me understand what's expected of me working here? Those are the kind of questions that you want to, at an appropriate point during your interview, ask.
I love those. And you can almost begin to sense, you know, almost based on the call it the aura of the room, right? If the director or the manager or the hiring new recruiter, as they answer, they should be able to answer quite confidently. And when they start to get a little skittish, that's when you start raising eyebrows. Nancy, can you go into kind of certain answers, whether they're, you know, explicit or implicit, certain big warning signs where you just kind of want to back away and run?
Yeah, you know, and you know, not to say that small providers don't have anything, because probably the heart and soul of who I work with are smaller providers, you know, in the private practice realm. And a great deal, many of them have an effective compliance program in place that's scaled. So, but when somebody tells you, well, we don't really have a compliance program because we don't have compliance problems, you want to dig under that a little bit and say, what do you mean you don't have compliance problems? Well, it might be that they perceive that they've been in business for 10 years, they've been billing Medicare and Blue Cross and the other insurances for 10 years, and nobody's looked at their records or nobody's told them they've had a problem. And that doesn't mean you don't have a problem. It means the first time somebody opens up your charts to take a peek, you might have a bigger problem than you ever bargained for. But when somebody tells you that they don't have a compliance program, you want to ask a little bit more about it. They might mean that they don't have something formal in writing, but if you say to them, well, do you routinely do chart reviews? Do you have any type of an audit or oversight problem? Do you have any way to ensure that what's billed is correct? You know, do you have any way to educate people? So it's understanding a couple of different questions to ask. Now, when you want to run is when somebody says, we don't need compliance. Nobody's ever asked. Yes. Ouch. And I think that when you see those types of things, even if they're waving a lot of money at you, and you've heard other signals in your interview that all of our patients are in, you know, 95% of our patients are in the high rugs. You're going, ooh, my goodness. Or all of our patients get 6 units in outpatient therapy, whether they need it or not. Or we double book our patients because we don't see there's a problem. Or, you know, other compliance-related issues, you know, that you can ask about. It's not a compliance question per se, but you can ask, will I be double booked? Will I be expected to bill for more than one patient at one time? And if so, will I be instructed how to appropriately bill? In other words, effective delegation to PTAs and techs per your practice act in your state and per the relevant payer rules. So, you know, a lot of people adopt Medicare rules sort of silently. They don't tell you about it, but it's hidden in your contract. And if the therapy company you're going to work with hasn't reviewed their contract or the online provider manual that will give them guidance on the relevant delegation and payer rules under their contract, and then you match that up with what's in your practice act, that's sort of a trigger sign too. Many therapists, Ben, that contact me, particularly in the private practice or outpatient setting are very concerned that they're being asked to see too many patients at the same time and aren't given instructions on how to appropriately treat the patient, document, and code and bill for the patient.
Let's peel that back a little bit, because I get that a lot too. In fact, I think that's probably the majority of reach outs that I'm getting now. Isn't so much, I think the SNF world and even the home health world with PPS, I mean, the rules are, I think, a little bit more clear, maybe more accessible. I don't know. But in outpatient, I think that's where a lot of the ambiguity is, you know, I have a mixture of patients today. In fact, I'm overbooked. I'm not even sure if that's okay. And my boss or the owner or the director is telling me, at 10 o'clock, I want you to see these three patients. I want you to group these guys, individualize the other ones. Let's peel that back a little bit and kind of cover a couple scenarios that are okay and a couple of scenarios that are definitely not so great.
Yeah, I'll have to give a quote from one of my favorite compliance officers who will remain nameless, but a former PT, an outpatient, now an attorney. And her famous joke is, back from the days when she was practicing, is, yep, I saw 32 patients today and billed for 35. So, you know, and that's always... and seriously, during the time that she was practicing, that was probably more prevalent around the country. You know, it was before the Balanced Budget Act and everything. You'd have to be an old timer like me. But, you know, a good thing to do is say, you know, can I see what the calendar looks like in this clinic? So, you know, what would my calendar look like? What would my schedule look like? And some schedules might be in your EMR and some schedules may still be on the, you know, the paper and pencil, you know, scheduling book or scheduling sheet. And then you want to determine, are the PTAs carrying their own schedule? Or do the PTAs team up and work with a therapist? And do you have PTAs that help out? So you have to understand who are the helpers there to help you in your clinic. So if you've got two patients that are scheduled in the time slot, but you have a PTA that's assigned with you that doesn't carry their own schedule, it's likely that you're going to be very appropriate with your billing, whether it's federal health care program like Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE, or any insurance plans that require certain payer rules, such as following the Medicare 8-minute rule or complying with the AMA CPT midpoint rule. So that gets very complicated. So sometimes those questions are hard to ask, but I would start with, you know, what will my schedule look like? Could you show me an example of a schedule? And if the person says, well, we can't show you a schedule because it's PHI, well, say, could you please show me a redacted schedule or a sample schedule, just in case somebody wants to give you an excuse for not seeing a calendar. And then
it's a little bit of a red flag right there, isn't it?
It is. It is a little bit of a red flag. So you want to find out how you're going to be scheduled and what help you're going to have available. And in some states, based upon the Practice Act for PTs and the Practice Act for other extenders in that state, for example, maybe athletic trainers that are working in conjunction with PTs. And, you know, a lot of PTAs are also athletic trainers. It's kind of, I see that phenomena quite a bit. But you want to find out who can be the therapy extenders, what insurance plans allow those people to work with you as a therapy extender. We know Medicare doesn't. Medicare, anybody except, you know, an authorized individual meeting the definition in the Code of Federal Regulations for a PT, a PTA, or a OTR, or a CODA, they're not going to be allowed. You know, they're going to be treated as if they were aides in the eyes of Medicare. But so you want to differentiate between, you know, what are we doing with federal healthcare payers and Medicare in your clinic, and what are we doing with other payers? What would my schedule look like? And do I have help? And what will I be able to delegate? And then presumably the candidate would have done a little bit of background, and maybe you're helping them with your service, Ben, on the Practice Act. Because one of the things I'm always doing when I'm dealing with compliance is looking at the Practice Act for that state and very carefully looking at supervision and delegation. And it's different in every single state. Every single state where you have to take a look at it. And so, in fact, in some states, unless you're a PT or a PTA, you can't write anything that's going to be in the medical record. For example, a flow sheet. Let's just say somebody's keeping a paper flow sheet of, you know, 10 visits in a row. And the patient might be working with a tech, to do some exercises, or the tech might be recording the exercises where it's allowable. But in that particular state, a tech can't document to the medical record. So then you have a flow sheet where the tech might have to write some comments on it, but the therapist has to do the documentation. So you look at all of those different elements. And I'm not suggesting that tech should treat patients, but there's certain things that are done, even non-billable things that are done, because you're providing good therapy during the session. So that's, you know, and I'm going to kind of segue into, let's just say a Medicare patient for a second. You're going to bill a Medicare patient. Let's just say you've scheduled them for 45 minutes. And if you strictly go on the 8-minute rule, if they're there for 45 minutes and you're doing all one-on-one codes, that's 3 units you're going to bill. But what about if the patient stays a little bit afterwards and is, you know, working on their home exercise program? You're not billing the person for it, and they're in the clinic and you've documented that they're in the clinic for, say, you know, more than 45 minutes, up to 90 minutes, for example. And I've seen that a lot in records. And the therapist notes that they are only billing for skilled therapy that was provided one-on-one. So the therapist is actually saying, I only billed for the 45 minutes when I can attest that I provided skilled one-on-one therapy. But the Medicare beneficiary may be working on a home exercise program, may want to, you know, get a little bit further instruction on stuff, may try to test out the new exercises that were given to him or her by the PT that day. So it's all in a matter of how you represent what you did in your record and how you code and bill for it. And anybody that you're interviewing with, where that question comes up of what does my schedule look like, they should be able to describe for you what I just exactly did. So the signal to run away, Ben, is if they're saying, there's no problem. We do everything. They do absolutely everything. And we, you know, our average units between, you know, all the dovetailed patients we have, you know, and that's the signal for me is when you see how many units are billed, and you can ask, what are your average number of visits per patient? And then what are the average number of units one-on-one per visit? And of course, asking, you know, other policies, are the techs able to assist with other activities as allowable in the state, for, you know, for example, if you're using modalities.
Nancy, if I'm correct, they can find you at Nancy Beckley on Twitter. That's NancyBeckley, as well as Google the Rehab Compliance Experts, trademarked. Guys, that is it for the first episode of this podcast mini-series titled Practice Compliance. There'll be more coming up, including answering questions about cash PT and what you need to do when you're kind of going through this tough time of not sure we're doing everything correctly here. There's going to be a lot more coming up, and this will actually be the longest of all the episodes. I'm planning on keeping everything in 15 to 20 minute bites, but this is, of course, kind of getting to that 30 minute mark. So I want to first thank you so much for being with me for this opening episode. It needed to be a little longer because we had to kind of lay down some of the ground rules, you know, and talk about what really is being in compliance and how important, as you heard it, that Nancy shared, that if we want to be able to have direct access, if we want to be able to practice at the top of our licensure, we need to advocate. So I'll leave you with that for now, and looking forward to connecting with you on the next episode of this mini series. This is Ben Fung, signing off.